Okay, we are here talking about systematic theology. We've been studying theology proper, which is the doctrine of God. And up until just a few weeks ago, we were studying God's works ad intra. That is God's processions of the Trinity, who God is in them, in and of himself. But now we're looking at the works of God ad extra. And the first thing God does is he decrees that this universe be and not another. And having looked at the exhaustive divine decree, we go to the next doctrine in theology proper concerning God's ad extra works or works external to himself, and that is the doctrine of creation. So what we're going to be doing today and next week is we will be looking at the case for an extremely important doctrine called creatio. Ex nihilo. Creatio ex nihilo. Who can translate that for me? Yes. Creation out of nothing. As the old Latin philosopher Lucretius said, ex nihilo nihil fit, out of nothing, nothing comes. And the church has always agreed with that. The church has always taught that God created the universe out of nothing. This doctrine is under heavy attack today from two vantage points. One is philosophical, and I guess you could add scientific, and the other is biblical. So what I'm going to be doing today is we're going to be walking very steadily through the biblical evidence for this doctrine of creation out of nothing. What does the doctrine of creation out of nothing state? It says that there was once a moment, if I can speak this way for a second, there was once a moment in which there was nothing except God. There was once a moment, really, when there were no moments. There was an eternal moment, if you will, and there was nothing else. God alone existed in the fullness of his splendor as the triune God. And then God said, be, and the entire universe came in existence from nothing. Okay. There's only one tradition that has ever taught this, and that is the Judeo-Christian tradition. Islam teaches it as well because they are heirs of this Judeo-Christian tradition. But all the other pagan philosophies in the world deny creation out of nothing. If you read the ancient cosmogonies, you will see that the gods are in constant war with an eternal universe. Okay. Now, before we even begin to talk about this, let's ask this question. Why is this important? So I'm throwing this out to all of you. Why is the doctrine of creation out of nothing important? And let me say as an aside, a lot of people believe that the debate on creation evolution is sort of where the action is. So do we all have the same common ancestor with all living things? That's not where the action is. This is where the action is. All right? In fact, the church has found it so important that there are creeds in the tradition, not ecumenical to be sure, but creeds of the tradition which say that this doctrine is so important that if you deny it, you're simply not a Christian. So, yeah, go ahead. Okay, so in the first place, if you don't affirm creation of nothing, as Steve just said, you don't really affirm the sovereignty of God, the transcendence of God, the fact that God is over all things. So without a doctrine of creation, God does not have his proper place, if you will. What's another important reason for this doctrine? Okay, expound upon that, please. Okay, so is God, I guess maybe the question is God really God if the universe is as eternal as he is? Is he? If God is competing with the universe for sovereignty, if he's trying his best, if he's giving it the old college try, but somehow the creation, because it's just as eternal as he is competing with him, is God God? No, God loses his very deity. We don't really have a God if there's no creation out of nothing. And so, I'll give you one more. All of the pagan philosophies throughout time that have denied creation out of nothing have always, inevitably, confused the creator with the creature. Take pantheism as an example. Pantheism teaches that God is everything and that the universe is eternal. Why must the universe be eternal? Because the universe is God. Or take something like panentheism or process theology. This is the idea that God and the universe are sort of codependent upon each other. The universe contributes to God's nature. God, in turn, contributes to the universe's nature. And they're kind of in a mutual admiration society, the universe and God. Well, if that is going on, then is God really worthy of our worship? Is he? I mean, we might as well worship anything in creation because it is just as eternal as God. This podium, the matter that makes up this podium, has been around as long as God has. So why not worship the podium? And it is also important for another reason. If God is not the absolute creator, can he really save us? Can he guarantee that we will be redeemed and we will be with him forever? If Thor walked in, I've done this little thought experiment before, but what if Thor walked into this room and said, "I am Thor, God of thunder"? My question to all of you is, would you become a polytheist at that point? Would you say, "Oh, I guess Yahweh isn't God, because here's Thor"? Would you? Exactly. You're exactly right. Somebody created Thor. So is Thor really God? No. He is a product of this universe. He is a product of the creative activity of God. And therefore, Thor, it'd be cool to see the hammer and all of that stuff. And yeah, Thor could beat you up. But Thor is not worthy of your worship because Thor is a creature like all of us. He's only different in degree, not different in kind. And so the doctrine of creation out of nothing preserves the deity of God, the creator-creature distinction, and it sets God apart from all other proffered gods in the history of the world. So do you see why this is an extremely important doctrine? Okay, who doesn't see why it's an extremely important doctrine? Any sonnets or poems about this before we go on? Yes. No sonnet. Oh, gosh.
I have a bunch of questions. The real question I want to ask, I know that the scientific community believes in, sometimes they believe in, the Big Bang theory.
Yeah.
Does that imply that there was matter, or is that a belief in creation ex nihilo without God having done it?
All right, so the question is the Big Bang theory the belief that the universe just began without God having done it? It's really interesting that you ask that question. The Big Bang theory is a wonderful theory that has landed in the lap of Christians, which is really just a proof of what the Bible teaches. Because what does the Big Bang theory teach? It says that all the matter, energy, space and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Well, what is that other than an admission that the whole universe came into being? And most people, when the evidence started coming in, most scientists who were atheists did everything they could to stop the Big Bang theory from taking hold of the hearts and minds of the scientific community. In fact, the word Big Bang, or the phrase Big Bang, is a phrase that was invented by Fred Hoyle as a phrase of derision. He was making fun of the idea that the universe popped into being out of nothing. And he offered a different view of creation called a steady state model. Well, that was thrown out the window in the early 1960s through a handful of discoveries, especially what we call the background radiation to the universe. Some guys working for Bell Laboratories discovered the background radiation. And that confirmed the Big Bang Theory. For those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, the background radiation is really the faint glow of energy that existed all the way in the beginning of the universe. And the idea is that if the universe did begin with a hot Big Bang, an absolute beginning, we would expect to discover this faint background radiation that would always exist as long as there's life on Earth and enough energy for stars and such, right? In other words, that initial energy, that initial boom, would leave a trace, and that trace was discovered. And when that trace was discovered, there were a lot of young budding scientists who became theists, because now the debate between the steady state model and the Big Bang model just won. Well, then what did the scientific community do after that? They said, well, maybe there have been a bunch of Big Bangs. So from all eternity, the universe sprang into existence and then collapsed on itself. And then it's kind of like a yo-yo or a slinky, you know. Just keeps going back and forth. And what inspired that? Hindu cosmogony. The Hindu tradition believes that Brahman is asleep right now. And guess what we are? We're his dream. You're the dream of God. He's just dreaming right now. And then when he wakes up, the universe will end, because the universe just is his dream, right? And then he'll move around for a couple billion years, do whatever he's going to do. Well, then he's got to go to sleep again. And then when he goes to sleep again, the universe comes back into existence, and the whole thing is all, it all happens all over again. And that's been going on for eternity. Well, what did we discover in the 1980s? We discovered that the laws of thermodynamics would not allow for this. In other words, if the universe were to collapse back on itself, it would go splat, not bounce. Because the laws of thermodynamics basically argue there's just a certain amount of energy in play that would not allow the bounce to happen. And therefore, if we have a big crunch, that's it. And therefore, there had to have been one beginning. Now, there are other models that have been offered in the 1990s, and there are still models being offered. But Alexander Vilenkin recently did a presentation at Cambridge, I believe it was. It was in England. He's a cosmologist up at Tufts. And he was asked, are there any good reasons, any arguments, any evidence whatsoever for an eternal universe? He goes, I know of no evidence whatsoever for an eternal universe. In fact, in one of his books, he says, we have to stop hiding behind the idea of a past eternal universe. There's just no good reason to affirm this. And there's every reason to affirm that the universe had an absolute beginning. So, Big Bang Theory, good. And the Christian community is upset about this a little bit when I say things like that, and other people say things like that, because along with it is an old universe. And we're going to talk about the old versus new universe debate. I have not made it any secret that I'm an old earth creationist. But for those of you that are young earth, there are still some arguments you can give for a beginning of the universe, and we'll talk about that. But go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I guess the monotheistic religions are the only ones that believe in creation ex nihilo.
Yes.
I guess Islam does also.
Yes.
Okay. So we could also, well, I was going to say, take out the word creatio, you could put scientists in there. They're with us.
All right, right. Okay.
So, admit it or not.
Very good. So while most scientists don't admit creation ex nihilo, most of them do admit ex nihilo, the ex nihilo part. Now, how did it get here? And because the absolute beginning of the universe implies a beginner, implies a creator, because out of nothing, nothing comes, or whatever begins to exist has to have a cause, this is why a lot of your astronomers are constantly searching for some new model to explain all the evidence. But I'll quote Stephen Hawking in his book entitled The Nature of Space and Time. He says, everyone now believes, talking about everyone, he means scientists, everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. So I want all of you to think about that. Time itself, the thing that you call time, had a beginning. Now, one of my, I'm proud to call him a friend now, but he's a person that had a huge influence on me when I was wrestling with all these things. Hugh Ross, when he was an atheist, he became a theist because of this evidence. And then he went and looked at all the holy books that had ever been written. He had just did this huge study, and he spent 2 years of his life as a... this is a guy who used to do lectures at his local junior college on astronomy when he was 16. Okay, so he's not an idiot. He spent 2 years of his life researching this stuff, and he said, this is the only holy book, the Bible's the only holy book that actually talks about the universe this way, in a way that science can confirm. And this is why he became a Christian. You know, he became a Christian because this was the only scientifically verifiable holy book that there was. So this is an interesting testimony, isn't it? So many people are denying the Bible because of science. In fact, he told me that, I'm not going to mention the name of this scholar, but an Old Testament scholar who used to work for BioLogos. BioLogos is a theistic evolutionary group. They're promoting theistic evolution. Reasons to Believe, that Hugh Ross is the president of, is a creation group. They deny the theory of evolution. And they're talking, he's talking with several of the people, and they actually said, let's give our testimonies. And so the BioLogos group, they were started by Francis Collins, who was a Christian, who is a scientist as well. He started the Human Genome Project, or he was the head of the Human Genome Project, you know. He started BioLogos a few years ago to seek an integration between science and Christianity. And Reasons to Believe, which is a far more conservative group, and Reasons to Believe upholds the inerrancy of Scripture and things like that. Some of the guys at BioLogos do not. So they've started a dialogue. In fact, there's a book that recently came out where we see that dialogue taking place. So for those who did, Evan stole it from me, and he's reading it now. And I'm mad at him because I want it back. But I've forgotten the title of it. But it's basically theistic evolution, a progressive creation, dialogue between BioLogos and Reasons to Believe. Anyway, in this book, you get to see, you know, kind of where both positions lay. Well, when they begin their dialogue, they each decided to give their testimonies. And when got around to Hugh and he gave his testimony as to how he became a Christian, one of the Old Testament scholars looked at him and very condescendingly said, well, Hugh, I'm elated that you became a Christian and all that, but your science is so wrong. Now, I want you all to notice this. The Old Testament scholar who denies the inerrancy of Scripture, denies the full reliability of the Bible, and so on, is looking at Hugh. He's not a scientist, and he's looking at an astronomer saying, your science is way off. Okay? And that's kind of what we're getting now. I mean, you'll hear Old Testament scholars say the following, and this is not true. They'll say, the human race began with no less than 10,000 people. You don't mind if I skip over to a different issue? Some of you are looking at me like, no, I don't mind. Are y'all having fun with this? This is a fun topic. All right. So this is a common model for human origins. It's kind of like an hourglass, okay? And here we have hominids. And we're not really sure which hominid it is because we've not been able to find a link between Homo sapiens and all the hominids that did exist, okay? But some people are offering possibilities and so on. So imagine you have, this is a common evolutionary theory, and this is called the Out of Africa hypothesis. Most scientists believe that the human race began in one geographical location, okay? That is in contrast to the multi-regional hypothesis, which is the idea that the human race began, you know, all over the world, right? So, because one of the questions that people had is, how did the Native Americans get to the Western Hemisphere? And that was a question in the 19th century that people didn't know they could answer. When Darwin came along, oh, we have our answer. They evolved from lower primates, the kind of the way we did, right? Perfect. Well, there are problems with that, and so the shift now has been towards this out-of-Africa hypothesis. So you have, say, millions of hominids existing. Maybe not millions, but hundreds of thousands or so. And then an environmental disaster happens. Some sort of environmental pressure happens to the human race, these hominids, and they die off, and a very small number of them goes through this environmental disaster, right? So these environmental pressures are such that really extreme morphological changes happen to where when they emerge from all of this, we have Homo sapiens sapiens, right? And at that point, it is commonly believed, there were about 10,000 of them. And from that 10,000, all of us came. Okay, so far so good. Now, you'll hear biblical scholars say the human race started with no more than 10,000 people. They started with no less than 10,000 people. This is extremely important wording, okay? That's not true. What is true is to say the human race started with no more than 10,000 people. Do you see the difference? The human race did not start with no less than 10,000. They started with no more than 10,000. It could have been 10,000. It also could have been 2, right? Or it could have been somewhere in between. Now, they are not going to admit that the human race started with 2 people, right? However, what they will tell you is that all of our genetic material traces back to 2 people. So every single one of us, and they call the woman that we trace back to, they call her mitochondrial Eve. And they call the first, can y'all guess who the man is called? Y chromosomal Adam, because all of us trace our ancestry back to 2 people that were in this pocket of people here. Which is very interesting, to say the least. Now, if you were to go, Hugh Ross and Fajrana go to these Origin of Life conferences all the time. They meet about every 4 years. And they also go to these anthropology conferences where they talk about human origins and human exceptionalism and all that every couple of years. And they say this, if you go to a cosmology conference where they're talking about, say, the origin of the universe, everyone is very excited. There's a lot of optimism. We're making inroads. We're narrowing down. There's several Big Bang models out there, and we're kind of narrowing them down to about 2 or 3. And you want 2 or 3 competing models in place because that serves as a healthy environment because they can compete with each other and you can narrow down your knowledge even further. Are y'all following me? That's good stuff. You go to an Origin of Life conference, pessimism. They are not happy. Talk about the origin of the human race, not happy. Big question marks. Huge, huge question marks as to how all this started, right? So anyway, I left topic. I'm not even supposed to be talking about this yet, but
it's my fault.
It is all Steve's fault.
But that picture is also the picture you draw for the Old Testament. Is there's all these people, and there's that's like not an origin picture. That's an after origin picture.
Well, you're not wrong. And so one of the interesting things about this whole discussion is that there are several models out there that you can compete with. Some models have suggested that Y chromosomal Adam lived thousands of years after mitochondrial Eve, right? Well, let's say that that were true. We actually have an answer. Why? Because we all come from Noah. But the women who married Noah's sons, their common ancestor actually traces back to Eve. So we would actually have an answer for that. But that freaks the anthropologists out when they discover such things. Now, these things are still being debated, and you know, I'm not really sure what the end game is going to be in terms of where they're going to land. Hugh Ross told me that in a conversation about this, he said some of the guys at these conferences believe that the human race started off with no more than 800 people. Now, when he was going to these conferences in the 90s, they were saying the human race started off with no more than 2 million. Now we're down to 10,000, and some are suggesting 800. So it seems like we're going a little bit closer to the biblical 2 as the decades go along. So it's actually an exciting time for all of you to be Christians and involved in this dialogue. I'm constantly encouraging Christian parents to strongly encourage their children to get into the sciences and study them. This is not something we should be afraid of. We should be at the forefront of this and not be afraid at all to put our biblical revelation to the test. Remember 1 Thessalonians, consider all things and hold fast to what is good. But I will have to shift gears now, and let's talk about creation of nothing. And the question is, first and foremost, does the Bible teach it? And the first verse that I think we should go to, guess what that verse is? Genesis 1:1. So let's go to that verse, and I'm going to read the first two verses here. And I know time is getting away from me, so I'm going to go through this fairly quickly and then pick up the pieces next week, whatever pieces are left. But starting in verse 1 and going to verse 2, this is what the scripture says. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void, or without form and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving or hovering over the surface of the waters. Okay, those are the first two verses of Genesis and the first two verses of the Bible. Some translations, in order to avoid the implication that the universe had an absolute beginning, translate these two verses as follows. When God began to create the heavens and the earth was formless and void, etc.
It was already there.
Yes. So, in other words, the translation will imply that when God began to create, the universe is already there. Now, why do some translations read that way? They read that way because some Old Testament scholars believe that we ought to use ancient Near Eastern cosmogonies as a kind of model for how to translate the Bible. In other words, they see Genesis as nothing more than just one more myth or cosmogony in a sea of other myths and cosmogonies that arose out of the ancient Near East. And what we need to do is we need to use that other literature to interpret how we are to read this literature. Okay? Now, I would like to invite all of you to do this. And a few years ago, we actually studied the book of Genesis. We spent 2 years on the book of Genesis. So for some of you, this is review, and for some of you, this may be new. But here's what I would like to do. For those of you that have never done this, I encourage you, I not only challenge you, I encourage you to go read some of the ancient Near Eastern myths. In fact, I read some of that material to the class. Go read the Babylonian creation myth, which includes the Epic of Gilgamesh and other stories about their flood tradition, and so on. In fact, that's the closest one, and I read parts of it to the class. I don't know if y'all remember just how stark of a contrast that creation story was with the biblical one. They have hardly anything in common. For the Babylonians, the elements were really personalized gods that Marduk had to defeat in a big cosmic war. And so the moon was a goddess that Marduk had to kill, and so was the earth. And so he basically killed gods and formed the elements, the planets, out of these killed gods. So what are you walking on? You're all walking on a carcass The earth is just the remnants of a dead god. Well, if you read through Genesis 1, and some of you have already read through it many times, there's nothing like that in here. So many people are now starting to shift gears, and it's slow coming. Old Testament studies are far more liberal in the academy than New Testament studies. Okay, so that's the bad news I have to give you. In the New Testament, there's been a couple of decades old shift towards more conservative datings of the text and things like that. And the Old Testament, it's all over the place. But I would like to recommend one book to all of you that want to do a further study on this. It's by John Oswalt, Oswalt, good Arminian scholar, good conservative Arminian scholar. John Oswalt, and the book is entitled The Bible Among the Myths. And what he does is he basically is this basic contrast between the literature that you're getting out of the ancient Near East and the literature that you're getting from the Bible. And one of the number one features that contrasts the Bible with the ancient Near East is worldview. The ancients, whether they were in Babylon or Assyria or Egypt or wherever, did not have a transcendent God. They didn't have anything even approaching that. And we're about to read some scriptures which actually present God as wholly transcendent with respect to his creation. So what they were talking about just wasn't what Moses, who I believe to be the author of this text, I don't believe Moses was talking about. Moses is talking about a single God who transcends the world he's created. Now, there's several arguments why this, what they call the temporal or linguistic translation of Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. There's several reasons why this is a false translation. Again, the translation reads, "When God began to create the heavens and the earth was without form and void." There's several reasons to reject that translation. So let's look back at verse 1. And you don't have to know Hebrew to appreciate these points, but knowing a little Hebrew might help, right? So I'm going to give you just a few things from the Hebrew. But first of all, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The first thing to note, and this is one of the sticking points that the new translations run into, and they have a hard time getting around, that last phrase there, the heavens and the earth, we call it a merism. And basically, it is an ancient Hebrew way of covering everything. In other words, when the Hebrews speak of Shemayim et Haaretz, Haaretz rather, when they spoke of the heavens and the earth that way, they're actually talking about the whole universe. So when you see Shemayim and Aretz coupled together like that, heavens and earth, for the Hebrew, that meant universe. That meant everything. The totality, all of it. And that point alone makes the Hebrew creation story unique among all the ancient myths, because never do you have the gods in these other stories creating everything. But notice, God, what does God create here? He creates everything. Everything you see is the product of God's creation. Now, there are two more points that I would like to make. One is another common point, that the Hebrew word here is bara. There are several words in the Hebrew for create. Okay, the other Hebrew word that's common is asa. And you'll see it often translated made in the Genesis creation story. So when God makes Adam out of the dust of the ground, the word is asa. Because how is he making Adam there? He's making Adam out of something that already exists, the dust of the ground. Okay. But the word bara is an interesting word. First of all, nowhere in the Bible is the word bara attributed to any creature. No Hebrew, in the Hebrew mindset, no creature baras. Only Yahweh can bara. Only Yahweh can create. So trace the word. You can do a Strong's Concordance, I guess, a study on this. You can just trace all the places in the Bible where bara is used, and you'll see that nowhere is it used of any creature. Now, that should be a tip-off here that something unique is going on. In fact, all through this story, Whenever you see the word create in most English translations, chances are you're seeing the word bara. And where you see the word make, chances are you're seeing the word asah in the Hebrew. And you'll notice that there are specific times where the word bara is used. It's used three times in verse 1, and then later in verse 21, he creates the great sea monsters or sea creatures. And then in verse 26, he creates human beings. And what he's doing, what we're being told here, is that this is an action of God where he's bringing something wholly new into existence. Well, if that's the pattern throughout the text, then obviously, bara means to create out of nothing. At least when he's talking about the totality of everything. And I've already pointed out to you that Shema, ha shemayim et ha aretz, the heavens and the earth, that refers to the totality of everything. So notice, a very unique creation verb attributed to God alone is being used to describe a creation of the totality of everything. And then finally, this is a point that I've made that I've not seen in any Hebrew grammar or anything, but and this might be a technical point. But if you look at the beginning of verse 2, that is a vav in Hebrew. And these little dots and lines underneath Hebrew letters is very significant. This is called a disjunctive vav, and this is called a consecutive vav. Am I doing this okay, Jeremiah? He's giving me a thumbs up. Jeremiah's a much better linguist than I am. So a disjunctive vav sets the verse apart, almost kind of like a parenthetical statement. Like, it would not be wrong, in my opinion, to put verse 2 in parentheses. Disjunctive vavs don't necessarily follow consecutively from what went before. A really good example of this is Genesis 15:6, right? It's a very important verse. Genesis 15:6 says, "Now Abraham believed Yahweh, and it was credited to him as righteousness." That is started off, that word now or and, is a disjunctive vav. And so what the verse is telling you is that this is not the first time Abraham ever exercised faith. In other words, his faith was exercised not necessarily in consecutive manner with what's going on in the story. Are y'all following me? Well, if this starts off with a disjunctive vav instead of a consecutive vav, it seems to me that verse 2 should be set apart from verse 1. In other words, you can't translate it when God began to create the heavens and the earth, etc. You must translate it in this absolute sense. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, again, I'm not seeing this point in Hebrew grammars or anything like that. I may have seen it and just forgotten it. But I actually have sent this argument to people that are critical of the traditional translation. I'm not impressed with their responses. And they know Hebrew better than I do, and it's kind of a fumbling paragraph that I get from them. What do you think, Jeremiah? Is that a fair point?
Yeah, very plausible.
So it's very plausible. So these points put together, I think, make a strong case that we should translate this in this absolute sense. And with the absolute translation comes something very unique in Hebrew culture vis-a-vis the ancient Near Eastern stories. You don't find anything like this in the ancient Near Eastern stories. You find an absolute beginning of the totality of everything. And most people are agreed that if you agree with the traditional translation, you are almost by definition agreeing with the doctrine of creation ex nihilo. Or at the very least, you're agreeing that the Bible teaches it, even if you yourself don't agree with it. Now let me give you a few more points here. And this confirms everything I've just said. When you read through Genesis 1, and many of you have done this before, and we're not going to take time to do it now because of time, but when you read through Genesis 1, you'll see some interesting things. God, or Elohim, is sovereign over everything. He calls things into existence. Just for example, he creates literally the air, the firmament. Right? What does that imply that he's sovereign over? In other words, he's creating the space in which all things exist and move. So he's sovereign over space itself. He actually sets the sun, moon, and stars to rule over seasons and events that go on in the world. What does that imply that he's sovereign over?
Time.
And the very fact that he's not warring with these elements is, do you see Elohim struggling with the elements in Genesis 1? Is he having a hard time with this? He speaks and it happens. So the very fact that he's absolutely sovereign over all of these elements that he's created is an indicator, is it not, that he is the creator of these things. He's the creator of everything. So it's not just Genesis 1:1. It is the whole context of the passage that screams out, first and foremost, God is the creator of all this, and second of all, he must be transcendent over these things. If he is the Lord of time, then what must he be? Timeless. If he's the Lord of space, what must he be? Spaceless, and so on and so forth. If he's the Lord of all the matter and energy in this world, what must he be? He must be pure spirit. And so that is the picture that we're getting of Elohim here in Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to read from a book.
Not to mention that Elohim is plural.
Yes, Elohim is plural, and some people have suggested that that might be a plurality of majesty, but some have also suggested that that might be an implication of God's triunity. Let me give the summary here of this book, and I'm about to tell you what the book is. Let me see. Bear with me. Here we go. Summary thoughts on Genesis 1. If you want the best defense of creation out of nothing that I've ever read, Paul Copan and William Lane Craig, Creation Out of Nothing, which is a biblical, philosophical, and scientific exploration of the doctrine. Again, the title is Creation Out of Nothing by Copan and Craig. And I'm just reading a summary of what they say here. Genesis 1 has several mutually reinforcing features that lead us to conclude its implicit understanding of creation ex nihilo. These features include the uniqueness of the Genesis creation account in comparison to other ancient Near Eastern epics, the literary elegance and the structured grammatical necessity of the absolute sense of Genesis 1:1. By absolute sense, we mean in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, not when God made the heavens and the earth, etc. Thirdly, the uniqueness of bara, as I just pointed out, and fourthly, the creation of God by his word alone. Hence, we see emerging a strong cumulative case for creation ex nihilo. In light of the entire fabric of Genesis 1, creation out of nothing is the only proper inference to draw. And they quote Ritterboss here, who says, Genesis 1 teaches creation out of nothing. I mean, he just says it. No other conclusion, they say, can properly be secured. And I want to say that again. No other conclusion can properly be secured. Craig and Copan are scholars who are not used to overstatement. They would only say that if all the evidence pointed in that direction. Okay, so where should we go from there? Let's look at least one more Old Testament text to secure the point. And then we will break for next week. And I'll spend 2 weeks on the biblical evidence for creation on nothing instead of just one. But let's go to Psalm 102. And this, I think, underscores the point, secures it even further for us. And starting in verse 25, the psalmist says this, of old thou didst found the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hand. So notice, there's the creation there. God is the creator of the heavens and the earth. And this is just a poetic way of making that point. He is the founder of it. And then, notice what he says, even they will perish, but thou dost endure, and all of them will wear out like a garment, like clothing, thou wilt change them, and they will be changed. But thou art the same, and thy years will not come to an end. What is the psalm saying? It's saying that every aspect of this creation is changing. It perishes. Well, what does that imply? If things perish, are they eternal? Well, if they aren't eternal, then what are they?
Finite.
They're finite and therefore created. So even a verse like this that is far more about the contrast between who God is and the creation, even a verse like this suggests, does it not, that God founded the heavens and the earth out of nothing whatsoever. I think that that is a good place for us to stop, except I think we have maybe a minute for questions or any thoughts before we end. Okay, well, we will come back next week and continue the study. Next is we're going to look at the New Testament evidence for this doctrine. Let us pray.